I start my morning talking to a group of young people with the 4-H program, and I talk to them about two topics which I suspect they were not predicting I would talk about. And I suspect that my discussions here today will be framed in a slightly different way for you all to think about. I think there's going to be a lot of conversation and discussion about Farm Bill, and there's going to be a lot of conversation and discussion about what the safety net's going to be, and there may be some discussion about other aspects of the Farm Bill, but I think that there are three issues that we need to talk about more fully in agriculture and in rural America that ought to be encompassed and incorporated in our conversation now. And in a word that could be summed up as the challenge of migration. First and foremost, there are young people who are migrating out of rural areas. There are young people who are migrating out of farm families, and that raises a challenge and a real opportunity, though, for those of us at USDA and those of us in the Department of Agriculture and those of us in government to formulate policies that will hopefully stem that out migration and encourage young people that there is indeed extraordinary opportunity in rural areas. And I've talked recently at length about what those opportunities are. The fact that there's still a significant role, obviously, for production agriculture and exports, the reality of the bio-based economy that is opening up new entrepreneurial opportunities, the local and regional food systems, which is exploding and creating opportunities for young people, particularly to get into smaller-sized operations, and the role that conservation and outdoor recreation will play in creating new economic opportunities in rural areas. There is indeed a lot to talk about to young people about the challenges and the opportunities of living and raising their families in rural America. But there are two other migration issues which we need to talk about. One of them was couched the other day when I was in North Carolina visiting with a group of ag leaders, and we were talking about immigration. And these ag leaders were concerned about the fact that they had been challenged in terms of workforce. And one of them explained it to me this way. We have a choice in this country. We're either going to import workers or we're going to import food, which is another way of saying that if we don't have a comprehensive immigration reform package that's approved by Congress, we risk the possibility of some of what we do in this country migrating to other countries, some of what we do in this continent migrating to other continents and to other areas of the world. We cannot take and should not take for granted that we will always have a robust commitment to agriculture. It's something that we need to attend to and work on every single day and not take for granted, and part of it is addressing this workforce issue. And it is a complicated issue. We have 1.1 million people working in agriculture in America today. The numbers will vary, but the most conservative estimate I've seen is that 500,000 of those workers are undocumented. It could be as high as 700,000. We obviously, as part of a comprehensive immigration reform, have to create a process by which those individuals feel that they can stay in this country and work in this country and contribute to this country. That requires a focus, obviously, on border security, but it also requires a pathway to citizenship for these individuals where they pay a fine, they learn the language, they pay their back taxes if they owe any, no criminal record, and essentially they go to the back of the line and work their way through and ultimately reach a point where they can contribute fully and completely as citizens. The interesting thing about that is that some of the agricultural business leaders I visited with are concerned about that pathway, not because they want to deny these individuals the opportunity to be legitimately here, but because they are concerned that we'll have a repeat of what occurred in the 80s when we had the last immigration discussion, where essentially folks were given an opportunity to stay. They stayed, but they did not stay in agriculture. They moved to other occupations. And so obviously, as we deal with this issue, complicated issue, we need help and assistance in ensuring that workers will continue to provide a labor supply for agriculture. That means that we not only have to have a pathway to citizenship for those who are currently here, but that we have to have a workable guest worker program. One that basically finds a delicate balance between the right number of people here to ensure that we have adequate supplies of labor, but also to make sure that we don't necessarily depress working conditions or wages to the point where it creates another set of problems, and that we have wage levels that are based on data wage levels that reflect that there's a difference depending upon where you live, where you work, what you raise, and what you do on a farm. And I think USDA has a unique opportunity, and it's one of the reasons why we have been providing some technical assistance to folks who are looking at these issues. We have a unique opportunity to partner with the Department of Labor in coming up with a system and a process that informs both the cap decision and the wage decision. And I'm hopeful that the Gang of Eight, the Senate, the House, ultimately sees the importance of getting this done and understands the significance of the migration challenge that this will create if we do not get it done properly. Obviously, the Department of Labor has a role in enforcement, but I think USDA is uniquely positioned with its footprint around the country to be engaged potentially in the implementation of any proposal guest worker system, and we are there to help, and we want to help, and we're willing to help. The second migration issue, the third migration issue, in addition to young people being attracted to stay in rural areas, the issue of comprehensive immigration reform in the workforce is the impact and effect that we're seeing with more adverse weather conditions and the potential migration both north and south of certain types of agricultural production because of weather-related circumstances. Climate change in agriculture, I think, is real. We've seen evidence of it in a number of different areas. The more extreme drought that we've seen, the flooding conditions, the more horrific storms that we've experienced, the bark beetle infestation is another reflection, which is why we sat down and did an assessment of the impact of changing climates on both agriculture and forestry and concluded that indeed there are significant challenges and that if we don't create adaptation and mitigation strategies, we could face a situation in which certain types of agriculture will migrate either north or south and not necessarily create the kinds of opportunities that are available today. This is a long range problem, but it's one that I think we need to be focused on and paying attention to. So that's why I've instructed our folks at USDA to continue, as we have in the last couple of years, doubling the amount of research in this area to identify practices, techniques, technologies that will allow us to better mitigate the impacts. It's why we've encouraged the seed companies to work on an accord that as seed technologies begin to expire from patent protection, that there is a process in which a more generic opportunity could be created that should spawn additional innovation. It's why we have instructed folks to really focus on water management, coming up with ways in which we can use substantially less water in the production of agricultural product. It's why we're challenging our NRCS folks to take a look at how we might be able to measure and gauge carbon storage capacities of our soil. Because it may very well be that rural America holds one of the keys to reducing the risk of climate change by utilizing our agricultural lands as carbon storage areas, specifically and particularly if we encourage multi-cropping. Breaking down the barriers to multi-cropping, creating insurance and risk management tools that will encourage rather than disencourage or disincent multi-cropping, and creating new market opportunities for what can be grown and raised. It's why we are aligning ourselves with 30 other nations and looking at the impact of climate not just on the United States agriculture but on our global agricultural activities in crop and livestock production and rice production. It's also why we have made a concerted effort at focusing on renewable fuels and energy production. We believe that there are opportunities for us to both mitigate and adapt to climate as a result of an aggressive green energy effort. It's why we'll begin a process of renewing our MOU with the dairy industry as it works to reduce its carbon footprint. Why we've instructed APHIS to be on the lookout for additional invasive species and diseases that may impact and affect crop production. And why we are encouraging the NRCS to use its Conservation Innovation Grant Program to begin the process of identifying new techniques and technologies and ways in which we can use our land to better deal with issues like drought. And it's why we are also going to focus a concerted effort on reducing food waste. We could reduce greenhouse gas emissions in this country by roughly 2% just by eliminating the amount of food that we waste. The challenge for us globally is that 50% of the food oftentimes doesn't get to the plate in developing countries because of poor storage, post-harvest loss challenges. In this country and many developed countries, a significant amount of food is wasted once it gets to the plate. I'm looking at the plates here today. There's some folks here the part of the Clean Plate Club, and others are not. But the statistics are pretty daunting when you realize that potentially as much as 30% of the food that is produced is not adequately or properly consumed and is wasted. If you start thinking about all of the land mass that is used to produce the food that ultimately ends up in a landfill or in a garbage disposal, you realize and appreciate that this is an area where we really need to begin focusing a bit more of attention, both in our homes and in restaurants and in facilities that service food. So these are three issues: the outmigration of young people, the immigration challenge of the workforce, and the climate that could potentially change and alter the way in which agriculture is conducted in the United States, that we also need to be focused on at USDA, in addition to whether or not we're going to have an adequate safety net in a farm bill, whether we're going to have a solution to the Brazilian cotton issue, whether we're going to have additional flexibility in our conservation programs, whether it's important to continue a commitment to renewable energy in the bio-based economy and local and regional food systems, and whether or not we should continue to provide additional resources for research, all of which are very important. But there are a lot of other larger issues that also need time and attention. And so given the fact that I'm with a group of reporters, I figured this would be a good place to get some attention to these issues. So with that, I'll be quiet and open it up for questions. Chris, are you, am I doing this or are you doing it?
Because you are the first question. You go ahead.
I get to do this? Okay, all right. So I'll just go around, one at a table, and we'll just circulate around here. Yeah. Well, we've been actually beginning the process of adapting to sequestration 2 years ago. We didn't wait for the sequestration to hit. We knew it was coming. Some form of it was coming, which is why we have been very aggressive. We've reduced our workforce by 8%. We've shut down 250 offices and labs. We're now in the process of consolidating rental space. We're taking a look at our vehicle maintenance and basically basing it on mileage as opposed to years in service. We're consolidating our purchases of technology. We're reducing travel, supplies, and conference spending by 42%. We are looking at every possible way in which we can be more efficient with the resources that we have. The result of that is that we were able to identify roughly $700 million in savings, which made it a little bit easier for us and maybe some of the other agencies to deal with the impacts of sequester as it relates to furloughs. We're still going to see fewer farm loans. We're still going to see fewer conservation plans. We're going to see fewer farmers have access to cost share and conservation. We're going to see a serious problem this fall with rental assistance, where 15,000 folks will no longer be able to get the assistance they were getting from rural development, which may cause problems with their housing. You know, we're going to have fewer home loans. APHIS is going to have to be very careful about precisely what it does in terms of these diseases and pests. Do we mitigate? Do we contain? Do we eradicate? Those issues are obviously driven in part by the resources that are available. How do we prioritize? So it's not easy, and it's particularly difficult when the workforce has been reduced and they haven't had a pay increase in 3 years, and some of them are going to be furloughed for a period of time, which is actually a pay cut. But our folks are a can-do attitude. We got a can-do attitude. The folks that are working at USDA, I think, are getting the job done. We've got a record amount of work that's coming out of our various departments, and I'm proud of that. We're going to continue to be efficient. We're going to continue to be effective, but we're not going to lose sight of these big issues. And we're not going to use sequester as an excuse for not dealing with the big issues.
In this morning's discussion on immigration, one of the few things that was clear they agreed upon was that whatever compromise came out of Congress, that there would be an emphasis that employers would be required to use E-Verify or a system like that. Some of the farmers have told us they have problems with that system currently, that even when you check your workers' numbers, you don't know for sure if that worker on the document. So going forward, what kinds of obligations do you see employers will have in verifying the authenticity and documentation of their workers?
Well, you know, I think you want to make sure that when you talk to folks about immigration that you are very clear about what aspect of immigration you're referring to. Because I see that there's a blurring oftentimes of the difference between this permanent pathway to citizenship, a guest worker system for folks who are in the high-tech, high-wage job area, the process in place for lower-wage, lower-skilled workers that are non-agriculture, and then there's the agricultural piece. And those are all different. There's not one size fits all. They're actually going to be separate, as I see it, likely separate systems. I think there is a way in which we can have large-scale producers and even some of the smaller-scale producers participate in giving us a sense of what their needs are, and then utilizing the fact that we have a footprint within USDA throughout the United States in virtually every county, there may be an opportunity for us to lend our assistance in making sure that we keep track of folks the right way. I think once you have a system where you're dealing with not 500 to 700,000 people who are not legally here, but you're dealing with a defined number of folks who have been given permission to be temporary workers, it will be a much easier system to administer, and there will not be the impetus or the motivation to encourage anybody else to come across the border, because you'll have an adequate workforce and you'll be paying a decent wage and things will be balanced. Right now the system is broken, and because we have a broken system, there are folks who take advantage of that broken system. There are folks who are trying to do the right thing in a broken system and are frustrated. So this has got to get fixed. It's got to get fixed. And it gets fixed by creating a permanent pathway for citizenship for those folks who are here and have been here for a long, long period of time and simply want to continue doing what they're doing and want their families to have access to citizenship. It gets fixed with a temporary guest worker system that understands that some folks may need a contract to work and some folks may be at will to be able to move around. And in doing this, you set up a reasonable amount, a number each year, and you basically keep track of that number. And you utilize the powers and the capacities of the Department of Labor and the Department of Agriculture to be able to do that. I'm confident this can work out. My point in talking about this today is that I think people need to understand what's at risk here. It isn't just simply fixing the immigration system. It's not just simply securing the border. It's not meeting the needs of various industries. I think there is a real challenge and risk to aspects of agriculture that it would be whether we're going to import workers or import food. And I, for one, would prefer not to import food. I think that we're a much stronger and more secure nation because we don't or don't have to. So I think comprehensive immigration reform is as much about food security in the long term as it is about access to workers and an immigration system that needs to be fixed. No questions over in this table. Oh, Aaron. Yes, Alan.
How much, taking a look at the emphasis of the issue, because obviously your concern is farm workers, but a lot of folks on the other side of the aisle are still talking about border and need to secure the borders. With any sort of farm worker solution, is border security any sort of factor in what you do assuage worries that the border still is not secure?
Well, first of all, I think it's to point out what's already been done in this administration relative to border security. Substantially more resources, both human and financial, have been dedicated to border security, and in fact, one would say that we're probably at a low in terms of the amount of folks who are crossing the border. So I think what we've been doing is working. Obviously, people want to have greater assurances, and you're not going to get a comprehensive immigration reform package unless there is some process and method, I suspect, by which folks are assured that border security is being addressed. But that should not be used as an excuse for not getting this done. Because there are a multitude of security issues, not the least of which is food security, that's at risk if it doesn't get done. We've got a broken system. Everybody in this country knows it's broken. It needs to be fixed, and it's up to Congress to get it done. Yes, sir. I'm doing a gender thing here, too. I'm trying to.
Sir, I'm my name is Darcy.
Oh, come on now.
And, come on.
They weren't surprised.
We're wondering why would the United States take that position, which in the eyes of Canadian producers seems to be more finesse rather than following the spirit of free trade?
Well, it's solving the problem that WTO presented to us. WTO basically said that it's okay for labels to be affixed, and it's okay for consumers to be informed. We just didn't like the way you did it, and so we're going to try to do it in a way that answers any questions about where something may have been raised, where something may have been processed or slaughtered. And in doing so, we provide consumers information. And we think it's very consistent, not just with the spirit, but also with the legal requirement that the WTO panel has presented to us. And that's the reason we did it, because we want good relations with everyone. Minister Ritz and I are actually meeting tomorrow, and I suspect part of our conversation is not necessarily going to be only cool, but also our Beyond the Borders initiative to try to make things flow more easily across our borders, and I think we're having some success at that. But we do have a legal responsibility to comply by the end of May, and we believe this regulatory proposal that we've put forward is, in fact, a solution to the problem the WTO has created for us. Chris.
Back to immigration, the agricultural groups would like to see the new guest worker program run by USDA. Has the administration taken a position on that? Is USDA capable of running an agricultural guest worker program?
Well, Chris, I think the position of the president is he wants comprehensive immigration reform, and he wants us to be providing help and assistance in making that happen, and that's what we've done. The president's position is pretty clear about what he's for. Let me say to the second part of your question, we are a can-do, as I said earlier, a can-do department. You give us a challenge, you give us a problem, we can address it. And we are, I think, uniquely positioned to provide assistance in the implementation of this program because of our footprint that is in virtually every county in the country. Now, recognizing that's our forte, that's our strength. Our strength is not necessarily what the Department of Labor's strength is, which is ensuring that working conditions are right and that wage levels are what they need to be and things of that nature. We can survey, we can provide information, we can create a process by which we use our footprint, but the enforcement of all of this will obviously be in the Department of Labor, but I think we can be of assistance. Yes.
Secretary Mossack, I'm Katie Meissen from GTN. My question is really related to the customer protection issues that are out there today. As you know, MF will mostly repay now, but some of the structural issues are still there. CFTC has their proposed rule, but that has some issues regarding residual interest with margin and capital charges. What changes can realistically be made in the next year to address farmers' concerns about their future markets?
You know, I have a tough enough job being the Secretary of Agriculture without doing Gary's job at CFTC. So I'm going to make sure that I'm consistent in my answer. We're obviously working through a regulatory process that is consistent with the instructions from Dodd-Frank and consistent with the desire to make sure that folks are indeed protected when they get into complicated financial transactions. I'm going to let it up to Gary and his team to talk about the details of what that entails. We're really focused right now at our place, not so much on their job, but on our job. And our job is basically to ensure that we continue to do everything we can to increase productivity, to protect crops and livestock from a wide variety of challenges, from pests and disease to climate change. You know, we are focused, obviously, as you could tell from my remarks, on the workforce issue because that's critical to our ability to continue to compete. We're going to continue to expand exports. We're going to continue to focus on ways in which we can grow markets domestically. That's what we're focused on. And in doing this, we think we offer farmers what they need from the United States Department of Agriculture, which is a way in which we can diversify income opportunities, a way in which we can maximize their income opportunities. And I would say in the last 4 years, we've seen the benefits of that with record farm income, record exports, record involvement in conservation programs, a record expansion of local and regional food systems, record development of bio-based economy. That's where our focus is. This is a silent table over here. Okay, you know, if you're going to lose your opportunity here.
Okay.
No, Jerry, not you.
No. I know that you're not going to be able to give us a lot of details, but is there anything that we can expect in coming the budget in a couple of days? And a somewhat related question, I know you've all shared this with you at AID, but any thoughts on the Food for Peace program and expecting to see some changes in the budget for that? Is there anything that you can say just sort of about your thoughts on, you know, obviously a pretty heated debate over how
you know, I really like my job, so I got to be careful what I say about the budget. Look, the budget continues to be a challenge because we're being asked, obviously, to continue to try to figure out ways in which we can do more with less. To give you a proper perspective on this, our friends in Congress sometimes get this confused. They look at our overall budget and they lump the mandatory and the discretionary and they say, my gosh, this department has all this money. Well, one of the reasons we have all this money is because Congress has all these mandatory programs, which basically require us to put money out. The money that we control, the money that basically pays for the operation of our department, the budget that I'm now working under is $1 billion less in the discretionary area than the budget I had when I first became secretary. But yet we're still required to do more work in terms of farm loans, home loans, business loans, conservation projects, research, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're actually doing all that because we've created these efficiencies. We're creating process improvement. So the budget is a challenge to continue to do that in a way that doesn't harm our basic responsibilities to rural America. We are going to continue to deliver for rural America with the budget. Now, will there be some issues where people will be critical because the funding won't be at the level they'd like to see? Yes. But I would say in virtually every area where that is the case, we have an alternative strategy to amplify, to leverage, to expand the amount of resource that could be invested, but not necessarily from only our USDA pot. Let me give you an example. I was in New York City last week, and I met with folks who are affiliated with large-scale investment banks who are very interested in knowing about projects at USDA. So, for example, if we have a backlog in water projects, wastewater, sewer, water treatment projects, rather than just bemoaning the fact that we have this backlog, let's figure out how we can educate folks from these investment banks about these opportunities because, frankly, they don't know about them. That it's not on their radar screen. It wasn't until we talked to them. It's now on their radar screen, and the question is how can we create a process where those projects that we're not able to fund still get funded, but they get funded in a slightly different way. So instead of us providing the cash, we facilitate. That's what we do. That's part of our responsibility. So in virtually every area where the monies are capped or the monies are reduced or there's a change that we're proposing because of the overall constraints that we're under, we're proposing a way in which the amount of work that needs to be done isn't going to be compromised. And I think that's what we should do. That's what the president wants us to do. I'm going to reserve comment on the food for peace issue because I think I wait until after the budget is submitted. But, you know, the status quo is wonderful when you got all the money in the world and you're not worried about spending more than you have. But we're not in that world anymore. We're in a different world. We're in a world where everyone has now agreed that we can't continue to spend more money than we take in at the level we've been doing it. So that means that things are going to have to change. And change is not easy, as the president often says. But, you know, change is not necessarily a bad thing because it does stimulate more creative thought in terms of how things can be more efficiently provided and how people continue to be helped. And, you know, that's, I think, the exciting aspect of whether it's sequester or whether it's the budget. And instead of bemoaning all of this, it's like, man, let's be creative about this. Let's figure out how to get this job. This is a puzzle we got to solve. Let's figure out how to solve it. And I'm proud of what we're doing at USDA because we are leveraging resources. We are figuring out ways to do more with less, and I think the results show it.
Yeah, Mr. Secretary Larry Drylin, Pikeville's Journal. Out in the prairie, we're already starting to worry about the drought and how we're going to mitigate it. What is USDA prepared to do already to work on mitigation of drought situations?
Well, we've done a couple of things. In Kansas and Colorado in particular, we've focused on ways in which we might be able to make it a little bit easier to store water, as scarce as it might be. We're working with the Department of Commerce on a better forecasting model to give people better confidence in longer-term forecasts relative to drought. We are continuing our streamlined disaster declaration process that will make those producers eligible for disaster loans, both from us and from SBA. I can tell you we have roughly 750 counties that have already been designated because of the way in which they line up with the drought monitor. We will continue to monitor this situation, and obviously we took steps fairly aggressively last year in terms of the impact on various aspects of agriculture. We'll be prepared to do that as well again, but we don't want to be premature about it because we want to see what Mother Nature has in store. You know, if you'd asked me that question a month or two ago, it would have been a little slightly more difficult circumstance than we face today because we got some late snows and some early spring rains. We'll see. We'll see what develops.
As a follow-up, did you know that I've been covering this meeting now for 22 years? You're the only Secretary of Agriculture who's ever been to this.
What do you eat?
I wasn't invited to eat. This is a truthful answer to a question.
It's a completely weird question.
It is a weird question, but here's the answer.
It's not a Stuart question.
When I was practicing law in small town Iowa, in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, I was three blocks from my home. So every day I went home for lunch. I had an opportunity to have lunch with my wife and my two kids who were at the junior high coming right across the street. So we were a family that ate together. When I became governor, there was a lot of work to do, and so I ate at my desk. And they brought something in, whatever it was, I ate it, didn't pay much attention to it because I was working. As the Secretary of Agriculture, that's what I do now. I almost invariably eat at my desk because there's a lot of work to do. So I'm going to go from here back to the office. I don't know what they've got for me. They'll have something for me, and it will be next to legal-sized paper that I've made notes on about the budget so that I can be in a better opportunity to explain all this stuff to you on Wednesday when I meet with a group of you to talk about the budget.
Let's do two more questions.
Oh, we're going to have to be, three more, unless this table sort of continues to be silent. We'll just do three more. One here. Yeah. Why don't you find out what his question is and see if you can see? That's what I'm trying to do here.
Last year, when you were with us, as I recall, you insisted that the farm bill be referred to as the Farm, Food, and Jobs Bill.
Food, Farm, and Jobs Bill. Yeah. It obviously didn't work very well.
That bill, which I won't refer to again by name, one, are you going to continue to insist on that sort of verbal formulation? Two, do you think we'll have one this year? And three, if so,
look, the reason we utilized the food, farm, and jobs description was to make sure that we made the case to urban and suburban legislators that there was something in it for their constituents so that we could gain the kind of support for a bill that you need to get a bill through the process. It is indeed a food bill. There's no question about that, whether it's about the production of food or whether it's the consumption of food, it's in that bill. It is absolutely a jobs bill. Anytime you impact agriculture, you're impacting one out of every 12 jobs in the economy. We're still a significant part of the economy, and so it's appropriate to talk about it in those terms, and we're all concerned about jobs. So it's a way of basically creating a far larger political support for the bill. So yeah, I'm going to continue to refer to it that way, and I think everybody should refer to it that way. I think names are important. That's number one. Number two, yes, we will. I believe we will have a bill this year because we have to have a bill this year. There's no question about the fact, not only do producers need solutions and a long-term view, a five-year plan, so they know what decisions they need to make about their operations. But there are certain parts of that bill that will resolve sticky issues for us. I mentioned Brazilian cotton earlier. That is an issue that has got to get resolved this year. And it's the farm bill that will essentially do that. So I believe we will have a farm bill. Now, as to the when, you know, you could make a lot of money if you knew when Congress was going to act. You'd be able to know who's going to win the game tonight. You'd be able to know a lot of things, right? I don't know when Congress is going to act. I know that what the ag chairs have said, which is that they're anxious to get started now, that the Senate is anxious, the House is anxious, and I take them at their word because both of them did their job last year, and I fully suspect Chairman Stabenow and Chairman Lucas will do their job this year. It then gets to the point where Senator Reid and Speaker Boehner have some say in the process. We've received some indications from Senator Reid that this is on his priority list. We have indications from at least Colin Peterson that he's had conversations with the Speaker saying he wants a farm bill this year, a food, farm, and jobs bill this year. So I'm assuming that we will get it done by the end of this year. But I will tell you that we have to get it done. Let me get this question straight. You're asking me to acknowledge whether or not we're violating the WTO. Really? Look, we're doing this because it's the law. It's just that simple. We're doing it because it's the law. We've instructed to put this program together. We put it together. Now, how much of it, if any of it, we use, as you say, to resolve the issue, is still not yet decided. And we'll make that decision following a review of all circumstances. This is an issue, obviously, where we have a significant oversupply, and we have some short-term issues, and by short-term, I mean issues that need to get resolved relatively quickly, like the oversupply and the storage challenges we have in Louisiana, versus just the oversupply generally this year and what we do about it and how we minimize the cost to the taxpayers of America, which we're going to try to do. Ellen? You're asking, I don't mean to be smart about this, but I want to make sure I understand your question. Are you asking the kind of technical assistance we're providing and inputting into the structure of the bill, or are you asking us what we would do if a bill were, what our responsibilities would be under the bill?
I'll take answers to both of them.
Well, but which one did you ask?
Both.
You didn't ask both. Which one did you ask? Okay, well then let's try again. Ask me the question you want me to answer.
I'm trying to get a clarification. You talked about separate roles of the Department.
Right.
And enforcement. But you seem to also imply that if there is an agreement on the guest worker program, that USDA's role perhaps in administering that or involvement in that would be greater than your current involvement with the current H-2A.
Well, we don't have our involvement now is primarily providing, as I understand it, providing a lot of statistical information under which the Bureau of Labor Statistics and surveys and so forth are conducted and reviewed and analyzed and determined to set wage levels. There's a possibility, if you have offices and locations and personnel in every county, that you might be that service might be utilized to keep track of folks as they come in and out of the country. Now, that's something that we would be uniquely able to do because we have the physical presence and the personnel in most of those counties, right? It's not something the Department of Labor could necessarily do because what they have are regional offices. But once we, you know, once you set up a system that says you got to pay folks X or you have to have this working condition, you know, that's not our job. That's Department of Labor's job to make sure that those conditions are met. And then secondly, I would say that we could probably go into greater depth in the amount of data that we provide. I think what's the system today provides one wage level, and the problem with that is that, you know, what happens in Vermont is different than what happens in California, which is different than what happens in Texas, and so you really need to have, you know, more of a finesse to your calculations that understand those regional differences. And then secondly, what a guy does in the field as a farm hand versus what a person does with, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment, different set of skills, maybe different wage levels ought to be calculated. How do you get those different wage levels? Well, you survey. How do you survey? Well, it's a combination between USDA and Department of Labor. So I think there are lots of ways in which we can help. And we're committed to helping because of the concern that I expressed at the beginning, which is if we don't help and we don't get this thing figured out, then eventually what's going to happen is a lot of fruit and vegetable production in this country is going to migrate to other places. And I don't think that's in the best interest of the farmers in this country. I don't think it's the best interest of consumers. I don't think it's the best interest of our economy. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to help, if we can, solve a problem that has been vexing all of us for far too long. Jerry, I'm going to give you the last question because you've been very polite and you obviously escorted me upstairs.
Thank you. When you're talking about offices in every county, does that mean the Farm Service Agency county offices? And the second question is, what is going to happen to Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food after Secretary Marion, Deputy Secretary Marion?
Well, boy, you're a greedy guy, aren't you, asking two questions?
They were short questions.
Yeah, okay. Well, obviously, it doesn't necessarily only mean FSA offices, but obviously it would include FSA offices. The Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food initiative, as significant as the deputy's role was in that, and it was very significant, she was the leader of that effort, is now at a place where it is part of the institutional thinking of USDA and is a critical component to what we do at USDA. My hope and belief and my goal is not just simply to maintain it, but to continue to improve it, to modify it, to expand it, to make it even more successful than it has been, and it has been enormously successful. In other words, it's going to continue. Jerry, this is not something that's driven by a single individual. This is driven by the need for us to continue to diversify markets, to create new opportunities for smaller producers, smaller-sized operations. It's an entryway for beginning farmers. It's a way in which we can get veterans who are interested in farming involved. It's a way in which we can create community. It's a way in which we create economic opportunity in rural areas. You know, there are a lot of multiple reasons why this is a good thing for us to do, and I think it's reflected in the fact that now major farm groups are recognizing that this is an important consideration. It's a multi-billion dollar direct-to-consumer sales is a multi-billion dollar part of agriculture. It's the fastest-growing part of agriculture. So why wouldn't we want to continue that?
Let's thank the Secretary. Next year we will invite him for lunch as a cost-saving measure for the federal government. Jerry.